From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Gorbachev resigned as president of the Communist Party over the weekend. On today's Fresh Air, we examine the shift of power in the Soviet Union in the wake of the collapse of the Communist Party. We talk with William Taubin, political science professor at Amherst College and author of Moscow Spring. Also today, we talk with actress Mary Beth Hurt. She co-stars with Barbara Hershey in the new thriller, Defenseless. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's Emmy Awards. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Appearing tense and subdued, Soviet President Gorbachev today pledged to preserve his national government. He said the time had come to move quickly toward a market economy, and he called for early national elections. But leaders of the Soviet republics expressed doubts about Gorbachev's ability to hold the Soviet Union together. The BBC's Bridget Kendall has more from Moscow.
President Nazarbayev of Kazakhstan, supposedly a key supporter of the new Union Treaty, said the events of the last week had changed everything. There was no need for a new federal parliament or defense ministry anymore. A future Soviet Union would have to be a looser confederation, its central functions reduced to protecting borders, communications, and international relations. That view was echoed by a Ukrainian deputy. He said the new Union should be a security alliance like NATO. And the Armenian leader, Levon Ter Petrosyan, was even more dismissive. The center is dead, he said, and walked away from the podium. All this caused the mayor of Leningrad to get up and warn the dissolution of the Union was coming too fast and could be used by communist leaders in republics to protect themselves from investigation into the party.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall in Moscow. The German government said it will decide on Wednesday whether to recognize the independence claims of the Baltic republics. German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher will meet tomorrow with foreign ministers from Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. He'll also discuss the issues with European Community foreign ministers. Leaders of Germany's opposition Social Democratic Party have demanded that the German government recognize the Soviet republics that want to secede. German officials are hopeful that Soviet authorities will hand over former East German leader Erich Honecker now that Soviet hardliners are losing power. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher says the German government plans to renew its request to Moscow for Erich Honecker's immediate extradition. The 79-year-old was taken by communist officials to the Soviet Union in March to escape murder charges for shoot-to-kill orders along the inter-German border. Foreign Minister Genscher says he assumes Soviet officials will now treat the extradition request favorably. Honecker's hardline protectors in the Soviet Union were defeated in last week's unsuccessful coup. The German tabloid Bild is also reporting that the Soviet government is ready to surrender Honecker and his wife to German authorities. A Dresden newspaper says the couple is currently vacationing at a luxury resort on the South Georgian coast of the Black Sea. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
Stock prices were down slightly today after a session of what analysts described as indecisive trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just under a point to close at 3,039.36. Declines edged advances in light trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 128 million shares. This is NPR. House Speaker Tom Foley has joined a movement to block legislation that would limit the terms of state and congressional representatives in his home state of Washington. As it's now written, the Washington State Initiative would allow Foley to seek only one more term in the U.S. House. Supporters of the initiative argue that it would prevent office holders from becoming entrenched in their jobs and isolated from the people. Opponents say that term limits would prevent representatives from gaining experience and seniority. Foley, Washington Governor Booth Gardner, and other office holders have joined a lawsuit to strike the measure from the November ballot. A report released in London today indicates aircraft may have a more damaging effect on the environment than previously thought. Janet Berry reports from London.
The conservation group Worldwide Fund for Nature says in its report that aircraft are a significant source of the greenhouse gases that cause global warming. The report says that aircraft pollution is not taken into account when predicting climatic changes from the greenhouse effect. Fumes from jet engines contain the same harmful gases as car exhaust, but their effect is multiplied many times by the thinness of air at high altitudes. The Worldwide Fund for Nature says that technological advances leading to more efficient jet engines will not be enough to reduce the effect on the environment. It calls on airlines to reduce the number of flights by raising ticket prices and says that business commuters and vacationers should choose alternative modes of transportation. For National Public Radio, I'm Janet Barry in London.
American high school students scored at the lowest level ever on the verbal skills portion of last year's Scholastic Aptitude Test. The multiple-choice college entrance examination is taken by most college-bound high school seniors across the country. The College Board, the private nonprofit organization that develops the tests, says that scores in math also fell for the first time since 1980. The board said many students aren't taking enough advanced high school courses. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as head of the Communist Party over the weekend, and it looks like the Communist Party is in the process of being dismantled. We called William Taubman to talk about what that means and to discuss the new shifts in power between Gorbachev and Yeltsin. Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's written 5 books on the Soviet Union, including Moscow Spring. He edited and translated Sergei Khrushchev's memoir about his father Nikita. Taubman is now writing a biography of Nikita Khrushchev. I asked Taubman to describe the current status of the Soviet Communist Party.
It appears that it is suspended, at least on the territory of Russia itself. It's Yeltsin, who's the president of Russia, has closed down its newspapers. Gorbachev, the union president, has asked the Central Committee to disband itself. It's not clear exactly what is happening in every province capital, but essentially it is out of operation. Its physical premises have been sealed, barred, and sealed. I watch Soviet television here, which we get on a satellite dish live from Moscow, and I've seen countless pictures of the front doors of the Central Committee, the Moscow Party Committee, and others with tape across them and policemen on guards with guns.
Is that the democratic way of handling the dismantling of the party?
Well, you know, this is a very important question, and it is one that requires some reflection. I think that to Americans, the word party conjures up something like the Democratic or Republican Party. The Communist Party was never like the Democratic or Republican Party. It was a state within a state. And insofar as its apparatus and its leaders were instrumental in plotting this coup against the elected constitutional authorities, it was a criminal conspiracy within the state. Therefore, I think to ban the party, at least temporarily, while investigation proceeds as to its culpability or that of its leaders, is not as undemocratic as it might sound. But having said that, I would go on to add that I am nonetheless worried, because although I think the moves taken so far can be defended on the grounds I've just tried to outline, there is a kind of momentum that is developing here, and it seems to be leading in the direction of, at least for some people, in the direction of a kind of witch hunt in which innocent members of the party who played no role whatsoever in these events and who were simply going about their business and other jobs, may be hounded and their pasts dredged up. And so in that sense, I take your question very seriously.
What are the signs that you see that this might be heading toward a witch hunt?
Well, I don't like at all the language that Boris Yeltsin has, or some of the language he's been using. He is a genuine hero, and his role in the events of this week was indeed admirable. But when he, in his funeral oration yesterday, when they buried the 3 young men who died trying to stop the tanks, he kept using the word enemy, vrag in Russian, enemy, enemy. And he also referred to the people who had made the coup as cockroaches. And this takes me back immediately to 1937. I'm in my book on writing about Khrushchev. I've been reading about that period again, and that's just the kind of language that was used over and over again by the Stalinists as they moved to arrest and liquidate people. Yeltsin, of course, is not doing that, and one surely hopes he won't. But he must know his history, and he should not use language like that as strongly as he feels.
Now, let me ask you about the Baltics and Moldavia, where the Communist Party has been outlawed. Are you concerned about witch hunts there, and what does it mean for somebody who is in the Communist Party?
Well, I am concerned about that. The democracy in the Soviet Union, naturally enough, means the chance for these republics to determine their own destiny. But the question is, how will they treat other ethnic groups within their own borders, and will they practice democracy within their own borders, even as they have claimed the right to do so? And one of the first tests will be how communists will be treated. Again, reacting to yesterday's news, I'm concerned because it sounds as if in the Baltic states there may be an effort to call to account not just the Communist Party leaders who deserve to be arrested for their role in the coup, but it sounds as if they may try to dig up the past of anybody who had anything to do with the Communist Party, and that this will be a kind of ipso facto automatic evidence that they deserve to be persecuted. I hope this isn't so. And if they're true to their own ideals in these countries, it won't be. But in the heat of the moment, with their national patriotic passions roused, it would be all too easy to lapse into this kind of behavior.
Not that anybody has the answer to this, but how do you throw off the oppression of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union without entering into a witch hunt?
Well, I think you do the kind of thing that's been done in Eastern Europe. To some extent, it's been done in Latin American countries where oppressive military regimes have been ousted and replaced by democracies. You try to make sure that in the process of reducing the power or eliminating the power of the institution of the Communist Party and of punishing whatever of its leaders have committed actual crimes, that you don't go after innocent individuals whose only sin was to be a member of the party in a time when, I won't say almost everyone, because the party was never more than about 20 million people, but still an awful lot of people were members, including many of the very same people who will now be punishing the officials from the past. You try to make that distinction between institutions and guilty people and other innocent individuals. But it's very hard, because although I drew the analogy to Eastern Europe and Latin America, there's another analogy which will recommend itself to especially the Baltic states and others, and that is the Nazi Party in Germany. There will be people who will draw the analogy between the Nazis and the communists, and will want to see something on a kind of domestic Nuremberg process, the kind of purging or attempted purging of Nazi officials and others that took place in Germany after World War II.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about recent happenings in the Soviet Union and what might lie ahead. My guest is William Taubman. He's a professor of political science at Amherst College, author of several books about the Soviet Union, including Moscow Spring, and he's working on a biography of Khrushchev. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is William Taubman. He's a professor of political science at Amherst College and has written extensively about the Soviet Union. You had an op-ed piece in the New York Times on Saturday that was about why you think Gorbachev should go. Why do you think he should no longer be the president of the Soviet Union?
Well, what I should say is that I think the events have moved so fast that although I think I was right on Saturday, on Monday, I'm not so sure. What I was trying to say in that piece was that if he did not change his tune, if he did not dissociate himself from the Communist Party, which he refused to do on Thursday and was only beginning to do on Friday, then he was not only a liability to himself in the sense that he would face increasing humiliation, but he was a liability for his country. His presence in the presidency would only further inflame the situation. On Saturday, he did break with the Communist Party. He resigned as its leader. He disbanded its Central Committee. And so in that sense, he took the step that he hadn't taken when I wrote that article. Given that, I think he might still be able to play a constructive role, because it was those very steps that he finally took on Saturday that will give him the, or have a chance to give him the basic credibility that he lacked on Thursday when he came back from captivity and started spouting the same old line. Now, the kind of constructive role I have in mind is as somebody who will attempt, and this seems to be what he's saying these days, who will issue warnings against witch hunts, who will remind people that there are innocent communists as well as guilty ones, who will attempt to see that the transition from the Soviet Union as it now exists to a what looks like a confederation will proceed in a kind of peaceful and deliberate fashion. These seem to be the things he now sees as his aims, and if he can pursue them effectively, I think that would be to the good. Therefore, I even in my piece on Saturday, I didn't say he should resign right now. He said he shouldn't. He should declare that he would not run for re-election. Now I'd like to withdraw that and see how he behaves.
Do you think that Gorbachev is an important balance to Yeltsin now?
Yes, I do, although I think the weight of the balance is all on Yeltsin's side.
What is it about Yeltsin that needs the balance of Gorbachev?
Well, it's primarily his power. Yeltsin is accumulating power at an incredible rate. And I can understand why he's doing that. I mean, leaving aside his personal ambition, which I'll get back to in a minute because that scares me, he's acting to seize this opportunity. If you live in the Soviet Union, if you're a Soviet citizen, especially if you're somebody who's been in the power, the area of power, you know how relentless that Communist Party has been over these years, how powerful it's been, how widespread its tentacles have been. How resilient it's been. Now it is wounded and it's dying, and this is the moment to move against it, and he is doing so. I say that's quite understandable. But power is power, and even if his intentions are worthy, to have all that power gathered in his hands would be ominous. And furthermore, there is evidence that he is a man who is not necessarily to be trusted with all of that power. He's a kind of impulsive man. He's an emotional man. He is a man who has behaved in the past with what seems to be irrationality. I have in mind some of his apparently drunken escapades. So he needs to be balanced. And if Gorbachev's the one, so be it. I hope there will be others as well.
Well, when you refer to his drunken escapades and irrationality, can you be more specific about the incidents you're referring to?
Well, I, you know, there were charges that when he toured the United States, he was drunk at various times. That I certainly cannot speak to, having not been present, and he has denied it. The one incident that I did have some exposure to on Soviet television had to do with the time when he wandered into a police booth in a suburb of Moscow, all wet and dripping and apparently carrying flowers in his hands, and told the seemingly incredible story of how he had been kidnapped by some people who threw him off a bridge into a river. What I actually saw on Soviet television was the moment when the then Interior Ministry of the Soviet Union told what was their official account of what had happened, namely that the river was a creek, and it was just 3 feet below the path, and that the whole story that he had told seemed to have been made up. And on this day, he was called to the lectern to account for himself. This was at a meeting of the Supreme Soviet. And he kind of walked up sheepishly with his eyes cast down and said, "This is a private matter. I have nothing to say." The whole thing was bizarre. It was a bizarre incident, and his behavior that day was bizarre. And that's the kind of thing I have in mind. It would not really be worthy of comment. It's part of his private life. But for a man who is collecting the kind of power he's collecting, it's the kind of thing that one should take note of.
For those of us who haven't really kept up with his political actions of the past, what are one or two of the things we should know about Yeltsin to help put this past week's events into some kind of larger Yeltsin context?
Yeltsin comes from Siberia. He was a construction engineer. He worked his way up in the party to become the party boss of Sverdlovsk. He made a reputation for himself as a kind of forthright, straight-shooting type. And Gorbachev brought him to Moscow early on after Gorbachev took over to be the party leader of Moscow. And there he made a point, Yeltsin did, of getting out of his office, getting on buses, standing on lines, going to stores, examining the meat that was there or wasn't there. And he won a lot of sympathy from Muscovites for this kind of display of populism. But he also insisted on criticizing Gorbachev openly and some of the other people who were allied with Gorbachev at the time, whereupon he was fired, Yeltsin was, as Moscow party leader. That very act of being fired was the making of the man, because he became, in the eyes of the population, somebody who had stood up and had been punished, undeservedly so, and had defended himself. He became a kind of martyr figure. But he was still alive, and he kept fighting. He seems to thrive on adversity. He seems to be at his best when danger is all about him. And so this week for him was really the perfect stage on which to display his talents. Another thing, he seems to have a gift for seeming modest, even when one wonders how modest he really is. I have in mind some of his language this week at the funeral oration, for example, for the young men who died in the barricades. He said he asked the families of the men who died to forgive him, he said, because he had not protected their sons. And then yesterday, when Gorbachev apparently offered him to award him, or wanted to award him, the highest medal of the Soviet Union, Hero of the Soviet Union, he declined. This kind of seeming modesty is very attractive under Soviet circumstances, where so many Soviet leaders have grabbed all the medals they could get as fast as they could. And I hope that this modesty is real, because it would be important for it to be on the part of somebody who's going to be as powerful as he will be.
You've talked about Yeltsin as the kind of political figure who thrives in adversity and who more than once has you know, been a martyr and then has risen from that position. What about his effectiveness as a policy leader, as someone who has a grasp of the difficult economic problems facing the Soviet Union?
Well, there's mixed evidence on that. Some of his associates who are in the Russian government, who've been thought in the West to be the most sophisticated and expert, have left him, saying or have quit his government, saying or implying that it was not all that much better than the Union government of Gorbachev, to which Yeltsin counterposed himself. But on the other hand, the fact that some of these people were there in the first place, and that others of them have remained, and that Yeltsin has gathered around himself a kind of brain trust of some of the most expert and sophisticated people in the Soviet Union, the best of the intelligentsia, speaks very highly for him. I know some of those people, and I've talked to some of them, and they say that he is aware of what the issues are and that he's a good listener and he can take advice from good people. So if that is the case, and it would appear to be, that's a very good sign, I think.
The Soviet system really bred conformity. You couldn't question or challenge authority. That's not the kind of psychology that really breeds democracy. Do you think that there's going to be just a lot of almost like personality change that's going to have to happen within the Soviet Union for people to really understand and thrive in a democracy?
I think that, I hope that will happen. I think it has to happen if the changes, if the revolution, which has begun so hopefully this week, is to bear fruit. Not only 70 years of living under communism, but centuries of non-democratic rule before them, has produced a political culture of passivity, of fatalism, and it's not too strong to describe it as a kind of slave mentality. And that's very hard to change. The generation that grew up under that is going to find it very difficult to learn to act as free citizens. In some ways, the future really depends on the coming of a new generation. And one of the most hopeful things about the events of this week was that new generation made its appearance on the barricades in front of the Russian government building, the White House, as they call it. I was listening yesterday, watching Soviet television, and the mayor of Moscow, who's a very, very articulate and intelligent man named Popov, said that for the first time he saw 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, whereas up until now the main supporters of reform in the Soviet Union have seemed to be people in their 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s. So the young people appeared, they mounted the barricades, they defended democracy, and as we know, three of their number died. One of them I found out yesterday from Soviet television was a young worker, an Afghan veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Another, interestingly enough, worked for a joint venture between Soviet Union and the West. And the third was an artist. And the three of them symbolize really the kinds of young people who came together at this crucial moment and on whom the future of the Soviet Union really depends.
William Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College and the author of several books about the Soviet Union. He's now writing a biography of Nikita Khrushchev. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mary Beth Hurt made her film debut in Woody Allen's drama Interiors. Coming up, we talk with Hurt about her role in the new thriller Defenseless. And last night was the TV industry's biggest night of the year, the Emmy Awards. Our TV critic David Bianculli has some morning after thoughts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. United Nations Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar says he's optimistic there could be an early exchange of hostages in the Middle East. He suggested a release could come as early as the beginning of next month. The Secretary General spoke after hearing from a special envoy involved in efforts to free Arab prisoners held by Israel in exchange for Western hostages and Israeli soldiers held in Lebanon. Christopher Powell filed this report for the BBC from Geneva.
After the flurry of diplomatic activity 2 weeks ago, the hostage negotiations entered what Mr. Pérez de Cuellar described as a less public phase. During this period of silence, however, the contacts have continued. The United Nations Special Envoy, Gian Domenico Pico, is reported to have been in Israel, and despite being on holiday in Portugal, the Secretary-General said he'd been in regular contact with all concerned. But he's so far refused to be more specific on timing, declining to give any hint that a deal has been reached between Jerusalem and those holding seven Israeli servicemen. But diplomatic sources here believe that some progress has been made, but they add cautiously that whatever accommodations have been reached, they're unlikely to be more than gestures to build confidence between the two sides. The first steps in what's turning out to be a long process to release the remaining hostages.
Christopher Powell reporting for the BBC. Anti-abortion protesters in Wichita, Kansas, have begun their seventh week of demonstrations. As Gordon Basham of member station KMUW reports, today was mostly peaceful.
Operation Rescue protesters continue to demonstrate outside local women's health care clinics. But unlike yesterday, things have been mostly quiet. About 100 Operation Rescue demonstrators marched peacefully outside one women's health care clinic. Wichita police, however, did arrest one person for disobeying a police officer. Local law enforcement officials had feared trouble following this past weekend's large rallies by demonstrators from both sides. Meanwhile, Operation Rescue says it has turned over the protests to local leaders, but vows to maintain a presence in Wichita as long as some of its leadership remains in jail. Three Operation Rescue leaders were jailed by federal judge Patrick Kelly last weekend for failing to post a $100,000 peace bond. For National Public Radio, I'm Gordon Basham in Wichita.
President Bush said today the U.S. is moving very close to recognizing the Soviet Baltic republics as independent states. Bush held a news conference today in Kennebunkport, Maine, with Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. Bush explained his caution, saying as a superpower, the U.S. has a special responsibility to be careful. Prime Minister Mulroney stated his government's recognition of the Baltics announced earlier today. On Wall Street, stocks closed slightly lower today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing just under a point to close at 3039.36. Declines led advances by a margin of about 8 to 7 in light trading of 128 million shares. This is NPR News. Cuba is worried changes in the Soviet Union will hurt Cuba's ailing economy. Cuban state radio said today 75% of Cuba's trade was with the Soviet Union, and any instability there directly affects the island's economic health. Soviet supplies of oil, raw materials, and food have already fallen off this year. Shortages are widespread. The radio broadcast gave no analysis of the possible political impact events in the Soviet Union might have in Cuba. The Castro administration has also said nothing about the demise of the Soviet Communist Party. In South Africa, one of three right-wing prisoners on a hunger strike appears to be close to death. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Henry Martin is a British citizen who's been charged with taking part in bombings that resulted in one death and several injuries. His targets were an office that is associated with the African National Congress and a group of black taxis. Henry Martin is one of three right-wing prisoners on hunger strike, but he has not taken food for the longest period. It's his 50th day today. He's now frequently in a coma, taking oxygen and some liquid when he regains consciousness. But there are signs that the government does not plan to release him from jail because it sees this case differently from previous ones. Martin has gone on hunger strike in order to avoid a trial, and the government seems to feel he should be tried before clemency is considered. The African National Congress today called for his release, saying it made no sense to create martyrs. I'm John Matteson in Johannesburg.
Fighting in the Yugoslavian Republic of Croatia intensified today. Federal troops and Serbian rebels in the republic began a major attack on Croatian forces. The Croatians were trying to defend a strategic town in eastern Croatia, located across the river from Serbia. More than 20 people were killed over the weekend in clashes between Croatian forces and Serbian rebels who want to remain part of Yugoslavia. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Defenseless is a new thriller with a preposterous plotline, but it's very entertaining, in part because all the actors are so good. Barbara Hershey plays an attorney who's having an affair with her client, a landlord who swears he didn't know his tenants were pornographers. My guest Mary Beth Hurt is Hershey's long-lost college friend, and as Hershey later finds out, is married to the client Hershey is having the affair with. In a way, this thriller is a weird comment on best friend movies. Mary Beth Hurt made her film debut in Woody Allen's drama Interiors. She also co-starred in Chilly Scenes of Winter, The World According to Garp, and Parents. On TV, she co-starred in the series Tattingers, and on stage she was nominated for a Tony Award for her performance in Beth Henley's Crimes of the Heart. She has two children with her husband, the screenwriter and director Paul Schrader. It's often hard to balance her home life and career. I asked her why she decided to take the role on Defenseless.
When I read the script, what I liked most about it was the relationship between the two women. There were two very good female parts, and that is usually not true. And I think everybody has had a friend, or if you haven't had a friend, at least you know with your mother, that you push each other's buttons. You know, you go home and your mother says, "Why do you always do this?" Or your best friend says, "You know, you could have gone out with this guy if you'd just been a little nicer," or something like that. And these two women, Ellie and TK, have always done that for each other, push each other's buttons. And I thought it was an interesting whodunit, and a different character than I'd played too.
There's something I think everyone will recognize in the woman that you play. She's the kind of character who's kind of prim in a way on the surface, you know, mm-hmm. Everything in its place, you know, beautiful home, not a spot of dust anything. Everything seems perfectly under control. Mm-hmm. You know, the orderly home life, this is all on the surface. We don't know yet what's going on underneath. But I'm wondering who you drew that characterization from, if there was someone in your life. I know there was someone in mine who on the surface really fit that description. Mm-hmm.
No, she's really a composite character. Oftentimes I do use somebody specific, and they're usually members of my family. But Ellie was a composite of several different people that I knew.
What are some of the traits that you brought into that in the composite?
You mean like mannerisms?
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff that she was doing with her hair and her hands, a kind of fluttering that I had seen of Southern women, in fact, do, and I thought it was appropriate.
I have to say, the hairdo that you have in that is mm-hmm. so subtly hideous.
Yes, it's true, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's just, it's perfect.
Yeah.
What went into the hairdo? Maybe you could describe it. I don't think I'd be very good at this.
Well, I don't know, it's sort of like a flip, you know. I think that I've noticed, in fact, and this is probably true of me as well, that women generally maintain the hairstyle that they liked at the happiest time of their lives. Now, for some people, that's 1967, and they're stuck with beehives and that kind of thing. And then there's still a lot of, you know, Sassoon haircuts walking around. And I think that what I wanted to do with the hair was create a facade, and that it came from probably what Ellie feels was the most successful time of her life, which was early in college when she was a sorority girl, probably in the early to mid-70s.
Now, did you talk with the film's hairdresser about what character you wanted your hair to have?
Yeah. Originally, I talked with a wig maker, and she agreed. She was very helpful, and there were two very good hair people on the show, and they managed to maintain it all the time.
Now, another role I particularly enjoyed you in was the movie Parents.
Mm-hmm.
You and Randy Quaid starred as the perfect 50s suburban couple from
right.
Middle America. You were perfect except for the fact that you made meat out of body parts.
Yes. Little sausage at home.
So the movie was this kind of great perverse comedy about normality.
Uh-huh.
And now you grew up in Iowa, which in our country is like the symbol of middle America
mm-hmm.
and American normality.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think of yourself as coming from a, quote, very normal American home?
Absolutely. And that character was specifically based on my mother.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, that was her hairdo in the 50s. Yes, I think, and in Iowa... I think one of the most destructive things I learned as I was growing up was that learned or was taught, I don't think it's true, was that there is a normal and we must all strive to be that, which is, I think, sort of the same as hoping you get all C's on your report card. It took me a long time to kind of grow out of that.
What was it that you were exposed to when you were young that made you think you wanted to act?
If this answer sounds a little pat, it's because I've been asked that question a number of times. I was born an actress. I think it's the same kind of thing as... I think you're very lucky if you know that. And all that remained for me was to identify acting as a profession. I think it's kind of the same as being... for me, it was kind of the same as being born a girl. You know, you are a girl. I was a girl. I am an actress. I am a girl. No, I am a woman. Anyway, that once I discovered that acting was a profession, that all those people on television weren't really at the Cartwright Ranch, then I immediately said to myself, oh, that's what I am.
Well, how did you know that you were born an actress? What made you realize that?
Well, it was what I always loved to do. You know, I was always pretending, making up stories and fantasizing different characters and forcing my sisters and my friends to play parts in my fantasies. And I had my parents took us to see touring shows in Des Moines, and I still didn't realize that what was going on stage, it's not that I was stupid, I just didn't think about it much, was not really occurring. When I did realize that was I saw a high school play in Marshalltown and saw people that I knew, kids that I knew, pretending to be someone else. And then it all just sort of clicked in my head. I said, oh, well, that's what I am and that's what I want to do. But I didn't tell anybody for a long time because... you can't. It's very kind of hard in Marshalltown, Iowa, to tell people that you want to be an actress. It seems like an impossibility.
You know, a lot of times when you're young and you're acting out your fantasies,
mm-hmm.
you realize some of these fantasies are pretty weird, and you maybe shouldn't let a lot of people know that you have.
Yeah, yeah.
Did that happen to you?
Oh yeah, certainly. And also, my sisters ridiculed me for wanting to be an actress. For a while, I was quite sure I was an angel when I was about 8 or 9. And that was something I didn't let a lot of people know.
What kind of angel?
What do you mean, what kind of angel? There's only one kind of angel. I was an angel from heaven.
and what did you want to do as an angel, you know?
Make people happy, you know. I made myself a little shrine in my closet and would go in there at different odd times of the day and sort of meditate.
What did the shrine look like?
I had made a burnt matchstick cross. I don't know if most children have made those at one time in their lives. And it was there, and it was on an orange crate with a little doily or something underneath it and some candles.
Was this hidden from your parents, or did they know
well,
about it?
Well, they knew about it. I didn't know they knew about it. But you couldn't miss it if you opened the closet door.
And when did you dismantle it?
I don't think I thought I was an angel for more than about 6 months. That was just too hard.
Good. Yeah. Right. So most people who want to be an actor or an actress, it's a kind of passing phase in their life. And even if they continue to want to do it, they don't have the vaguest idea how. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to actually become something like that. Mm-hmm. So what was the course of action you planned for yourself to actually do it?
Well, I was the same as most people. You know, I just felt that I wanted to do it and I felt that I could do it. I went to the University of Iowa and got a teaching certificate in theater and art to please my parents. And then I came to the School of the Arts in New York, which is now the Tisch School of the Arts, and which is a practical acting school, which helps to give you a craft. And then I got married right out of school, and we went to London for a year and came back, and I went to work in a store because I was afraid that if I auditioned, I would be turned down, and I didn't think that I wanted to go through that. So finally, I started buying the newspaper show business and backstage, and I went to an audition way uptown someplace. It was an off-off-off-Broadway theater, and I was cast as... I was 24 at the time, and I was cast as a 50-year-old drunk, alcoholic woman. And a little light bulb went off in my head and said, if they're going to cast you as this, you can get cast as something else. So I turned the job down and started auditioning.
Why did you turn the job down?
It wasn't a very good part. And also, even in my own head, at 24, I looked very young, and I thought, I'm wrong for this part. You know, it was silly for me to play this part.
And how soon did it take to get a role that you thought you were right for?
Not too much longer.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is actress Mary Beth Hurt, and she stars in the new movie Defenseless. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress Mary Beth Hurt is my guest. Now, you mentioned you were married when you started performing. You were married. That was your first marriage. You were married to an actor, to William Hurt.
Mm.
I'm just curious if it's difficult to be an actor married to an actor when you're both getting started, if there's a lot of competition within the relationship.
Yes, it was extremely hard for us, and it didn't work.
Because I'm part of the competition?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think probably, especially in acting, it's a profession that leaves you vulnerable to every insecurity because there's always people judging you.
Yeah, and I think I think being any kind of an artist, whether you're a painter or a poet or a musician or an actor, requires, or at least exhibits, a certain neurosis. I don't think that painters see color in the same way that I see color. I don't think that composers hear music in the way that I hear music. And I think that actors are probably sort of hyper-acute emotionally, and that makes it very hard for them to sustain a relationship, certainly with each other.
As an actress, what are some of the things that you think you see when you look at other people that other people don't see about themselves?
I don't think it's that they don't see it about themselves. I think that each person knows themselves better than anybody else could possibly know themselves or know them. And what I see may, in fact, be a projection of what I'm feeling, not what they are actually feeling. But what I believe I sense is more of the subtext than say, someone who is not an actor feels. More of the fire underneath, the emotion underneath.
You're married to the director and screenwriter Paul Schrader.
Yeah.
I wonder if you feel like you've learned anything about acting by either watching him work or talking at length making movies.
Yeah, we just worked together for the first time. I swore I would never do it again. But he's shot a film this summer called Light Sleeper, which he also wrote, and I play a psychic in it. And I was very reluctant to do it because who I am as an actress on stage or on a film set or any kind of a set is very different from who I am as an individual. I am much more demanding as an actress. I have a much shorter temper. And I was concerned that it would make me, that being married to the director would make me self-conscious, less able to work in the way that I like to work. It wasn't a terrible experience, but I guess I would do it again. But I think in a way, I was right. I was somewhat inhibited by his being the director, and I think he was probably somewhat inhibited by my being the actress.
Did you feel less enthusiastic about demanding what you felt you needed?
I just knew in the back of my head at all times that I was going home with this man at night, and I didn't want to take what might have been going on during the day home.
Yeah. So are there things that you think you've learned from each other by...
There's a lot of things that I've learned from Paul. He's the most honest person I know, not just the most honest man I know. I've learned a lot of stuff about theater, not theater, about film. And I suppose he's learned quite a bit about theater from me. We have kind of the same sense of humor and tend very much to like the same sort of things. It isn't like we sit down and have long film discussions. We don't really do that. The only problem with Paul is that he falls asleep in all of my performances. It's not just my performances. He falls asleep in every single ballet, opera, concert, even rock concerts. In the middle of the concert, he'll fall asleep. He gets about, 10, 20-minute nap, and then he wakes up again. It's very aggravating.
Oh, gee, I think I'd get pretty offended.
Well,
no. He falls asleep during my performance, yeah.
Yeah, that's just what he does.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mary Beth Hurt co-stars in the new film Defenseless. This is Fresh Air.
Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what are you looking at from the Soviet Union?
Lots. We'll be hearing about Mikhail Gorbachev's appearance before the Supreme Soviet, also more that we know now about the chronology of the coup, actually. On this end, we'll be talking with historian Richard Pipes about some interesting precedent for what's happened this past week in the revolution of 1917, but not the great October Bolshevik Revolution, the one that took place in February. And we'll be hearing about various movements for independence in the Soviet republics and how genuine they truly are. In addition, a talk with documentary filmmaker Fred Wiseman about his first one, Titicut Follies, which now he is finally able to exhibit in movie theaters.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last night, millions of television sets were tuned to the 43rd annual Emmy Awards. TV critic David Bianculli is sorry to say his was among them.
How do I hate last night's Emmy Awards telecast? Let me count the ways. I hate the fact that The Simpsons wasn't allowed in the Best Comedy category, and that The Civil War wasn't even included in the on-air Emmy show. Then again, they had to make room for that thrilling, outstanding casting for miniseries or special award. I hate that last year's Oscar telecast, in the variety specials and writing categories, beat out such hard-working series as Late Night with David Letterman and In Living Color. I hate the lack of logic in the fact that Separate But Equal won for Outstanding Drama Special when it failed to win a single previous award in any of the writing, directing, or acting categories. I hate that Peter Falk was up for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series when Columbo wasn't a series last year. It was three individual telemovies spaced months apart, and neither ABC nor the Nielsen ratings considered it a series. So why did the Academy? Because the Academy has different definitions for things, that's why. Take the word comedy. That was supposed to be the theme of last night's show, but most of the scripted lines were more like anti-comedy. Take, for example, this pre-presentation patter between Corbin Burnson, who plays Arnie Becker on L.A. Law, and Christina Applegate, who plays Kelly Bundy on Married with Children.
Well, you may be wondering why an unlikely couple like Corbin and I are presenting together. Well, it's fairly obvious. You see, every week I play an immoral, low-class dimwit.
That joke is lame enough when it makes the audience supply the punchline, because everybody knows where it's going. The problem is, they keep going.
And I play a lawyer.
And go.
Same difference.
But nobody on last night's award show took a bad joke further than Gilbert Gottfried. He started off with a funny impression of Jerry Seinfeld, the best of the show's three co-hosts, but didn't stop when he was ahead. Instead, he launched into a routine that began like this.
I want to get something off my chest. You know, I'll tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. I sleep a lot better since Pee-wee Herman's been arrested. Masturbation's a crime. I should be on death row.
That joke wasn't bad, but the one that followed it was. And the next, and the next. Godfrey did six, count them six, additional jokes about masturbation, each one less amusing than the last. But don't worry, I won't repeat them here. Instead, I'll jump ahead to the only truly funny moments of this comedy-themed Emmy telecast, starting when Kirstie Alley, who had won as Best Comedy Actress for Cheers, tossed in an unusual thank you to her husband, actor Parker Stevenson.
And I wanted to thank my husband, and I didn't want to thank him like, you know, I really love him and everything. So I'd like to thank my husband, Parker, the man who has given me the big one for the last 8 years.
Seinfeld's double take after that was priceless. And with the very next award for Best Comedy Actor, Burt Reynolds picked up the Emmy and the joke. The impromptu speech by Reynolds, in fact, was funnier than anything provided by any of the Emmy show's writers.
But this is just, you know, I feel a little bit like Kirstie. You know, I'm not real good at the sincere part, but I want to thank my wife for giving me the big one for the last 11 years.
And after Reynolds left, Seinfeld stepped in.
A lot of big ones, big ones. Could be a balloon payment, for all I know.
Those last few minutes of the Emmy telecast provided spontaneity, entertainment, and good humor, three things that had been absent from the previous 2 hours and 45 minutes. Last night's Emmy show took one small step forward by canning the production numbers. If next year's show cans the canned dialogue and lets funny people react and interact more naturally, it'll be an even bigger step. Presenters hate to say those prepared lines almost as much as viewers hate to hear them, so dump them. And that's no joke.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. By the way, David says the Fox network, which televised last night's Emmy Awards ceremony, decided to cut out Gilbert Gottfried's jokes when it rebroadcast the show for the West Coast. We'd love to hear your comments about Fresh Air, so if you have something to tell us, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The saxophone is most associated with rhythm and blues, jazz, and rock and roll. Bernard Johnson has brought the saxophone into the church, playing gospel music with abandon. Now he has his first album on a major label. We'll meet Bernard Johnson on the next Fresh Air.